Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Remembering D-Day, 75 years later, President Trump joins the Queen and other world leaders for a ceremony in Portsmouth, England, where General Eisenhower saw off the greatest Allied amphibious invasion ever to liberate Europe from the Nazis. My conversation with the U.S. Ambassador to France, Jamie McCaw. Then
he exploded off the floor.
He electrified the stage, redefined ballet, and became an international superstar. A new documentary tells the incredible story of the Russian dancer and Cold War defector, Rudolf Nureyev. The film's director and narrator join me. And
it's so much fun. I love the form. I love the hang. I love working with other comedians.
Patton Oswalt, funny man, actor and writer, tells our Hari Srinivasan about entertaining the crowds and using comedy to heal his grief.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. And 75 years ago, more than 160,000 Allied soldiers were preparing to storm the beaches of Normandy in France to liberate Europe from the Nazis. The American General Dwight Eisenhower was supreme commander of these Allied forces, half of whom were Americans. It was the largest seaborne invasion in history. And today marks the start of 2 days of remembrance. Earlier, President Trump joined the Queen and other world leaders in Portsmouth, England, which was one of the key embarkation points. He met and spoke to veterans who took part in D-Day, which was codenamed Operation Overlord. Of course, all of them now are in their 90s, and it's probably the last time there is this gathering of veterans. Some perhaps may even remember General Eisenhower giving orders of the day, which were full victory and nothing else. That was the command. D-Day was pivotal. It was a turning point in World War II, which was one of the most significant victories for freedom over tyranny anywhere. Tomorrow, I'll be in Normandy, France, as the commemorations move there and President Trump meets with President Macron. And I've been speaking to the U.S. Ambassador to France, Jamie McCord, about the significance of this moment. Ambassador McCord, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much.
Well, this is an amazing day for an American ambassador in France. The president will be on his way to the country that you're ambassador to. And you're making all these plans and preparations to receive him. I know you're in deep conversation with the French government, the French authorities. What have you had to do? What is the planning for this major visit to the D-Day sites on this anniversary?
You cannot possibly imagine. I never would have dreamed how much goes on when the president comes to visit the country. It is quite incredible. It's incredibly mammoth for an undertaking. All of the embassy is involved. People around the country are involved. The French are involved. It is momentous, as it should be for a commemoration like this. And it's a true celebration of the bilateral relationship between France and America.
So talk to me a little bit about that, because, you know, this is something so important. It was such a turning point during World War II, and it was the major entry by the United States into this war on behalf of the alliance. Talk to me about what it means to America and what America has meant to France and to Europe in all these years.
Well, it goes without saying that the relationship between the two countries is incredible for so many reasons. As I like to say, because I'm an angel investor, I don't think that people should forget that America was a startup and France was our first investor. So they were there with us from the beginning. And similarly, we were there for the French, and World War II is certainly a fantastic example of all of that. D-Day especially, and the Normandy beaches have become emblematic of all that happened that day, whether it's the 15,000 jumpers or the 60,000 people who debarked on the shores. There are so many reasons to never forget all the lives that were given by the Allied forces and certainly the Americans on this day.
It's just so interesting you mentioned that the French were there for America and America was there for the French, you know, some 200 years later. You're talking obviously about Lafayette and how he helped America fight off the British way back in that war. And of course, how I guess the United States paid it forward to relieve them and liberate them from Nazi occupation. So fast forward. You speak French, don't you? I mean, I know that you did some of your studies in France, and you've just said you're an angel investor. Yes. You are a businesswoman by profession. You're now an ambassador. What has it meant to you to represent your country at this time, under this presidency, with this sort of, I mean, you know, it's not lost on you. There's quite a lot of tension between the United States and Europe.
First of all, it's thrilling. It's an honor. And I am truly privileged to serve my country and absolutely serve this president. I think that he is remarkable. He is trying to accomplish everything that he set out to accomplish. He's living up to his campaign promises, and he is not going to sit still until he moves America forward. So I, for one, am absolutely honored to be here under all of these circumstances.
What made you a Trump supporter? Because previously you'd actually often supported Democrats, or at least sometimes. I think you may have supported Obama. What flipped you? What was the reason that you decided to make that change and that investment in President Trump?
I think, like many Americans, I was watching the loss of hope for many people in terms of having the American dream. And because I'm truly a product of someone who grew up with the American dream, I am the first one educated in my family. I'm from a family of immigrants. I was the first one to go to college. I believe that education is the great equalizer. And I believe that if you work hard enough and you care enough about something, that you can get to where you want to go. And I don't think this was lost on the president. He understood that middle America was getting lost in the shuffle. And I think he capitalized on those opportunities, and he's delivering. And I think that's what I saw in him. And that means the world to me, to keep the middle class, which is the backbone of America, and to perpetuate the American dream.
So, again, bring it back to France. Again, I said that you did some of your studies there. You speak French. You are ambassador now after being a businesswoman. What about the relationship between President Trump and President Macron? We all saw that it started off really well. And then over the last year or so, it's cooled somewhat. I mean, that's our impression. Is that how you see it?
Absolutely not. I think that the best thing between these two presidents is that they talk often and they have no problems telling each other what they think about any subject that crosses their minds. I kind of equate it to a family. I have brothers. I have disagreements with my brothers, but at the end of the day, they're still my brothers. And so you figure out how to work around it and how to talk about everything that you have to talk about. So I think that it's wonderful that they have that kind of relationship. They're not afraid to broach anything.
And actually, I mean, you're right. They do talk perhaps less often than they used to, according to the White House phone logs. But they have disagreements on climate and on Iran, the Iran nuclear deal, and other issues of populism versus, you know, European globalization, etc. Interestingly, President Trump had a very pleasing visit to France where President Macron put on a wonderful military parade. Well, it's the annual military parade for Bastille Day. And President Trump hosted President Macron and his wife to the White House, one of the first state, in fact, the first state visit that he hosted, and it was for President Macron. In the meantime, everybody talked about this bromance. When I put this idea of bromance to the outgoing French ambassador to Washington, Gérard Araud, this is what he said to me.
I think this idea of bromance didn't make any sense. Simply, President Macron being elected, as any French president, you know, wanted to have a good relationship with the most powerful man on earth, which means the American president. And so it was totally normal. The fact is that the men disagree on most of the issues, so they have defined what I would call gentlemen's disagreements.
So that was a nice way of putting it, diplomatic, gentlemanly disagreements. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I would agree with that piece, absolutely.
As you know, President Trump has put his political capital here in the United Kingdom with the Brexit project. He's supported and actually talked to some of the main Brexiteers even while he was here on his state visit. And he's also weighed in on French and European politics and on what he views as the EU. How do you think that will play when everybody is gathered together on the beaches of Normandy and the idea of shared sacrifice and shared commitment to these multicultural and multilateral alliances that the United States built for the world, that some seem to remain in doubt? What do you think the president will say about multilateralism, NATO and the rest of it when he's here in France, I mean?
Yes, I think what's really clear is that this is a time to celebrate everything that we have in common. And first and foremost, we have shared values of democracy and freedom and liberty. And so I think those are the hallmark things that he's going to focus on, as he should. I think that at the end of the day, there are a lot of disagreements about a lot of things among a lot of different people. But what really matters the most is protecting our freedoms and keeping us safe from terrorism and making sure that each of our countries is secure. And those are the freedoms that we have to focus on, and certainly on a day like D-Day.
And do you think there'll be any sort of, awkwardness because of the president's tariffs on the EU, which obviously affect France as well? And in fact, he has, you know, he's tweeted, he said the World Trade Organization finds that the European Union subsidies to Airbus, which is obviously the French aircraft, has adversely impacted the United States, which will now put tariffs of $11 billion of EU products. The EU has taken advantage of the US on trade for many years. It will soon stop. This was about a month ago he said that. What sort of conversations do you have with the French government about these kinds of tweets and these kinds of trade tariff actions?
Well, it's very interesting because what he's tweeted is a fact that was found by the WTO. So he's not tweeting anything extraordinary. He's not tweeting anything that came from him alone. And so his way of communicating, as we all know, is through tweets and through social media oftentimes. So I think he communicated exactly what the finding was. So I don't think there will be any awkwardness around it because everyone knows what the finding was.
And do you have sort of pointed conversations, I mean, with the government about the tariffs and things like that?
I don't think that it's my place to have those kind of conversations. Those conversations right now take place either at the WTO level or at the EU level, where they're trying to sort everything out. My portfolio is really about the bilateral relation. And in those conversations, we talk about everything, but we leave it to others in their realm to deal with those matters.
So let's go back to Normandy and tell me what the president will see when he gets there on D-Day. What particular events? And also, I guess it's probably the first time he's been to the American cemeteries, Colville-sur-Mer, others. You've been involved in the planning. How do you think the impact of the visuals there will affect him?
Well, I can only tell you from my own perspective because I've been there before, even prior to becoming ambassador. And no matter how many times people tell you how moving it is, and no matter how many times you may have seen Saving Private Ryan, it's impossible to understand how overwhelming the feeling is when you go there. And when you see the 9,400 crosses that are there over people buried or being commemorated there, it takes your breath away. And let's not forget, we all think of beaches as romantic places or places where we take our children. And yet, there it is, where all these soldiers were killed trying to come in from the beaches. And it's just impossible to get your arms around.
It really is.
I think he'll be overwhelmed as well, to be honest with you.
Yes, and I wonder also, I mean, I know it's, you know, not for you to get into the president's head, but when you consider that, you know, a lot of the vets who he'll be meeting, whether at Portsmouth or at D-Day in Normandy, it perhaps is the last time that these vets in their 90s now will ever be able to come to a commemoration like this. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
I think he will be incredibly moved. He has a fondness not only for the military, but for the vets. I think he's keenly aware that this could be the last time they can make the trip. I think he'll be amazed to know that one of the vets who's 97 years old is jumping from a parachute, as he does frequently when he comes to visit, I'm told. So I think it's going to be incredible, just amazing, really.
And the eyes of the world will be on the Normandy beaches and on D-Day. Ambassador McCourt, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, while Russia was on the side of the Allies in World War II, a Cold War between the former partners dominated the late 20th century. Rudolf Nureyev became the first Soviet artist to defect during the Cold War. Considered the greatest male ballet dancer of his time, perhaps ever, he was the jewel in the Soviets' cultural crown. His defection, while on tour in Paris, was a huge blow to Russian prestige in 1961. It was a critical moment of history which was chronicled in the new documentary Nureyev. And here's a clip.
The people in Paris loved him.
Beatlemania, but it was
Ballymania. The Soviets suddenly realized that his personal success undermines the general success of the whole company.
KGB minders say he's getting out of control. We need to bring him back to Russia. And if he does that, he can defect.
He was petrified. Petrified of fear, but nothing would have stopped him.
Featuring never-before-seen footage, the film is directed by the siblings David and Jackie Morris. David joined me here in London with Dame Sian Phillips, actress, widow of Peter O'Toole, and friend of Nureyev. She narrated parts of the film. Dame Sian Phillips, David Morris, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, look, Nureyev, for people of a certain era, is, you know, the symbol of the greatest ballet dancer we've ever known. But for people who don't know, and the people who will watch it today, a whole generation has grown up not knowing who he was. Why did you decide to make this film about him?
Because he's reached that point where people of a certain generation, everybody knew who he was. Everybody thought he was one of the greatest stars in the world, whether it was in dance or anything, really. But because dance is ephemeral, after he died, he's sort of slipped away from public consciousness. And we thought it was a challenge to bring him back, you know, and really show what a huge person he was, such a huge personality and such a big talent.
You know, you talk about a huge personality. I'm going to ask you, because you did actually meet him.
I did.
And did you see him dance?
Oh, yes.
So let me just read this little review, because it sort of, you know, sums him up. For a while in the West, he was like Nijinsky meets Mick Jagger meets Salman Rushdie, a freedom fighter in the body of a leaping rock star god. Well, that, of course, talks about his defection from the then Soviet Union.
Yes.
But also the charisma, the animal magnetism, the sexuality that he projected. What do you remember about Nureyev?
Just that.
I'm going to be quiet now.
I'm going to put it better myself. No, that's exactly what it was like. It was extraordinary to meet him, even as a young thing when he'd just arrived, before we saw him dance properly. Even then, he was amazing to meet. And then when I saw him dance, of course, it was extraordinary. And then I met him quite often in that period. And it was always very exciting. But very often one is left with the... After people die, you remember all the things they did that were that were funny, that were stupid, that were, you know, people are such a mixture of things. And of course he was great, one knew that. But this film really reminds one of, I was in awe after I'd seen it, which I hadn't really felt when I was meeting him. I was stunned after seeing it because it really delivers the greatness.
And it's interesting to hear you say that because you are obviously in your own right a great dramatic artist. I mean, you're an actress, you perform, you don't sing and dance like he did, but you perform and you know what it takes, and you had a huge impact on stage and on screen. I just want to play this little bit from the Morris documentary because it's you and your sister, right, who've made this documentary, Nureyev. It's you actually narrating something that was off stage. It was Nureyev at a dinner party that you all attended.
He did that thing that great dancers do. You know, they make ordinary gestures look wonderful. He just turned and picked up a bottle of cherry brandy and he lifted it and he just drank the lot. And the room was quite silent for a moment. And then he seemed to levitate onto the table. And it was beautifully laid with crystal and silver. And he just walked down the table towards his hostess. And in those days, every woman had her hair done in a very elaborate way with maybe four hair pieces on the top, you know, bits and pieces. And he just reached out and flicked the top hair off one of the guests. And she was delighted. You know, instead of being cross, she went, oh, what?
I can see you just laughing, reliving that. I mean, it is so eccentric and it's so entitled. I mean,
oh, yes.
Did he know that nobody would say no to him?
Yes.
It's as simple as that, right?
Yeah.
So let's get back to why that is then. I mean, just put him into context. I talked about Nijinsky. He was the first great Russian ballet dancer that we know. Nureyev is known as the best male ballet dancer ever, perhaps. Just describe what ballet meant at that time, how the Soviets had such a lock on that element of culture.
Well, they couldn't compete with the West on any material level, apart from the space race and ballet. And those, I mean, it's a strange thing, but those were the two things. They had the best ballet companies in the world, and they got a man into space first. What is interesting about Nureyev is that after Yuri Gagarin went into space, it was just 2 months after that that Nureyev defected. And he was the great hope of, you know, ballet. So it was a complete disaster for them. But 2 months after Nureyev defected, the Berlin Wall went up. So he is sandwiched right in the middle of that. And I think we these days don't necessarily think what a big event it was when he defected. It was just all the papers and everything. And so he burst onto the scene, a bit like the man who fell to earth, the David Bowie thing. You had this sort of creature from the Soviet Union who was so beautiful and so talented, and everyone was enthralled by him.
I don't remember because I was too young the actual defection, but I remember what a big deal he was, not just culturally, but also politically.
Oh, yes.
He was invited on all the talk shows to talk not just about his ballet, but about what was going on between the Soviet Union and the West. Do you recall those moments?
I do indeed. And I remember thinking how brave he was. And this comes out in all his work later, of course. He had such stature, even as a young thing who just leapt over that gate. He was an amazing person. He was so sure. He must have been terrified, but he was so sure of himself.
And just for you to explain to us, for those who haven't yet seen the documentary, he didn't actually plan to defect. It sort of came about at the last moment. Just explain for new readers, so to speak.
They were in Paris, and he was the great star, the great draw of the Paris Opera. But he was being very, very naughty with the KGB, and they were getting really, really annoyed with him. And so they decided that they weren't going to take, the authorities, the Russian authorities, said that he wasn't going to go to London, which was the next stop. And they made a real pig's ear of it because they told him at the airport, they made out that, oh, Khrushchev wants to see you
dance. Who was the leader of the Soviet Union at the time.
Soviet Union. And then somebody else said, oh, your mother's ill, we've got to fly you back. And he went, ah.
Which one is it?
Which one is it? And I know it's neither. Mm-hmm. And so it was literally at the airport that he decided, I can't do this, you know, I can't, I've got to make his jump to freedom.
And it was literally a jump. I mean, he threw himself into the arms of the authorities, police, at the airport.
Yes, he did.
That's the most dramatic.
Oh, it was unbelievable.
So, of course, we're playing some beautiful pictures as we speak of the sheer brilliance of his execution of ballet, of the dance itself. Mm. And I wonder if you remember his amazing partnership, which really put him onto the world map in the West with Dame Margot Fonteyn, who was the greatest ballerina that the Royal Ballet has ever known. Yes. Just walk us through that a little bit, because she was a good deal older than him, perhaps at the end of her career, maybe.
Yes.
And they both kept each other alive.
Yes. And he owed her so much. And I was very, very interested to see that she meant so much. When she died, he was shattered. He was really, really upset. Although they hadn't seen each other for a while, I imagine. But she meant an enormous amount to him. And, of course, they had a lot of fun together initially at that time. And he rejuvenated her. And she was so wonderful because she really did appreciate him so much. Apart from, she didn't teach him things, though she must have taught him something. But she was so nice with him. And when she's asked what was he like, she says, well, he was a genius. And when you say, well, what is a genius? Well, a genius makes magic. And that's what Rudy did. He made magic.
Well, then let's play the clip that we have from the film. David Chase is narrating this amazing dance, the amazing performance of Romeo and Juliet.
There was a reverential, profound love that he had for her and respect. Again, maybe interfused with who knows what else. And that scene, the balcony scene, I remember when he did some kind of variations and he just exploded off the floor when he had come from that exchange. And I get goosebumps thinking about it.
Nureyev did have homosexual affairs, a long, long relationship with the great dancer Eric Brune. But I want to pick up on what the dancer David Chase said. He had this relationship with Margot Fonteyn that was based on dance and who knows what else. Do you believe that there's evidence that they had any romantic entanglement at all?
Well, I don't know, but I know that Margot Fonteyn's official biographer believes it's quite possible. No one will ever know.
No one will ever know. I would have thought it was possible as well. Yeah.
And of course, she made him, you know, in a way. He gave her longevity, but her partnership made him the foremost dancer in the West.
Yehudi Menuhin said
The
great violinist. He said Margot Fonteyn turned him from the lion to the panther. And that's a great way of putting it, I think.
Yes.
It is. You found 16 minutes of film that had never been viewed before.
Well, we found a lot of film that hadn't been seen before, but we found 16 minutes of really important stuff. And it's mostly the American choreographers like Martha Graham and Murray Lewis and others who, for lots of sort of legal reasons, most people can't get hold of. But because it was our own company, so we could take as long as we wanted to make the documentary. We weren't given enough 6 months or something, so it took us 3 years. And so we had the time to really fight to get this stuff.
And just talk us through, because the Martha Graham stuff that you're talking about is this incredible, you know, Nureyev into modern dance. I mean, he had never tried it before, and he was a massive success at that.
Yes. I think she said he had a hunger for the new, and he did. You know, he's almost like Alexander the Great crying because he got no worlds to conquer. he conquered ballet, and so he wanted to go on. He wanted to go on because he knew he was mortal. He knew that, like a dancer, it's not like a writer or something else. You can go on and on and on and on and on. But for him, he knew that it was a cut-off point, and he wanted to experience everything. It's a bit, you know, it's sort of like, do you want a short life and be famous or a long life and be mediocre? And he chose a short life.
You are in the movie because you are chosen by the Morrises to narrate the part of the film which are Nureyev's own memoirs.
Yes.
What struck you the most, if I can ask you that? What was it about seeing his memoirs, narrating them, that touched you?
Well, they seem to reveal a more vulnerable... I mean, you do think of him as Alexander the Great. You know, he was invincible as a person, it seemed to me. But in the letters, you do find some other qualities, the vulnerability, I suppose, and... because there was a thoughtful side to him.
I mean, as you say, he's very thoughtful about himself. He really understood himself, and he understood the world around him as well. Because brought up in such extraordinary poverty. We don't know. I mean, he escaped from a Moscow when the Nazis were besieging the city, and then he was a refugee in Ufa. And, you know, living in complete poverty, and that makes you very self-reliant. Yes. And so later in life, people often say he was horrible because he could be, you know, very, very selfish. But to the people who were close to him, his Russian friends and people like Margot Fonteyn, and people he trusted and would allow in, he never forgot them. I mean, he always sent money and stuff surreptitiously to his Russian friends and never forgot them.
And particularly, I think, it's very touching. After Gorbachev and after the wall came down in 1989, he did actually go back to see his mother.
Yes.
At the very end. End of her life. She was dying. And so, you know, that's one of the great tragedies of his life. You know, he had that... You know, he was a huge star in the West... but he couldn't see his mum. You know, that sort of makes politics into a very, it brings it down to a human level.
It does, and it has to be also, again, retold that his mum supported him. It wasn't necessarily the thing to do in Soviet Russia for a boy to become a dancer. His dad didn't like it at all, as you recount, and pretty much punished him. But his mother was very, very important. I just want to ask you both about, we've talked about his sexuality. Let's talk about the sadness and the sorrow of the historical accident in which he was born. I mean, if he had been born later and had had AIDS, he might have been okay, given the vast, vast improvements that have happened with drug therapy. Yes. Instead, he wasn't, and he died in 1993. Take us through that period, and particularly at a time when it just wasn't talked about. And, of course, we remember the great moment when Princess Diana went to a hospice and they thought, was she going to wear gloves? And she didn't, and she shook hands, and she immediately calmed a lot of the hysteria. And he talked about that.
Well, he didn't actually talk ever about AIDS publicly because it would have been... There were practical reasons. It was very difficult to travel if you were known to have it at that point. And so he never really talked about it. I mean, to his friends, yes, but never publicly to the press. And some people say, well, you know, in that position, he should have spoken out. But it would have meant political... It would have meant suicide, in a way. He could never have gone to Russia, for example. He could not have probably gone to America. I'm not quite sure how it worked. But, yeah, and, you know, there was a great, great stigma. People didn't... Before, we have... Princess Diana in the film because she was a patron of the Royal Ballet, and she was his friend, and she, as you explained, she'd made that. I was around. I remember it. It was made a
I remember
huge,
it too. Huge impact.
Huge impact. I think people don't understand now what a huge impact it was. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, and he's it is a tragic. It is a tragic end. Mm. And he would have only been in his early 80s now, 81 or something.
Yeah, he was, I think, 54 or so when he died.
I mean, 38.
Very. You know, he's asked a lot about freedom. You use in the film the Bob Dylan quote, "No one is free, even the birds are chained to the sky." When Nureyev was asked where he belonged, he didn't say to any country. No. He said, to dance.
To dance, yeah.
What was his relationship with belonging and his relationship to freedom?
Well, I think when you're... I mean, he literally is divorced from his country. Yeah. I asked his official biographer, his official biographer, what passport did he have? And she actually went, do you know, I've never thought about that. But when he first came to the West, you know, he was stateless. And I think great artists like that are always in the in the literal sense, but they become stateless, don't they? It's something that is, they they don't belong to one country.
No, they don't. It's a good thing in a way.
Yes.
What do you think his legacy will be? And the legacy of ballet and dance and what Russia has given to the world.
Huge, I would imagine. Absolutely huge legacy. Yeah. And this is a film that helps that legacy because memories do fade, you know. And the even I saw him dance the Corsair, you know.
One of his great performances.
I have never seen anything like it in my life. And the reaction of people was extraordinary, unbelievable.
Can you say something about Axes never get that kind
of... No, axes don't get applauded like that, like musicians or dancers do.
You're a little jealous.
I felt as though I'd been transported to another planet. I thought this is going to go on forever. It was unbelievable, the effect he had on people.
I think it was unlikely you were ever going to get ballet as high profile and as sexy and as, you know, again. Because I think it's very difficult to...
Good to be a dancer. It's very disciplined. The Margot before Nureyev was quiet and sort of very restrained and
very
didn't
English
talk a lot.
And then suddenly she became this wild, unleashed panther.
They are so disciplined and they have to obey and they don't talk a lot and they're not noisy. But that he changed everything. Yeah. One had never seen a dancer like him.
Anyway, it's a really, really beautiful film and well done for bringing him back to people who loved him and to all of those who need to know him. Dame Sean Phillips, thank you for sharing your memories. And David Morris, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Our next guest may not dance, but he has done it all in Hollywood. Patton Oswalt is best known for playing Spencer Olchin in the CBS sitcom The King of Queens and for lending his voice to cartoon characters. His stand-up comedy show, Annihilation, nominated for an Emmy Award, is touring the UK and the US this summer. And it's a lesson in heroism in the face of adversity. He spoke to our Hari Srinivasan about his career and healing grief with laughter.
So while you're not doing stand-up, you're on, I don't know, 6, 7 TV shows, a movie or two?
I think so, yeah. I've got a movie that's coming out. Animated. Secret Life of Pets 2, I did voiceover for. So that was a little more manageable than all the TV shows that I was doing.
That's still acting.
It's still very active. Yeah, it's very active, but at least I didn't have to get into makeup and, you know, get into costume. I could show up in sweatpants. So that was good.
Is that why most of Hollywood loves the voiceover gig? They just stay in sweatpants?
Voiceover is such a relief from the, okay, make sure your camera ready. Make sure you're wired. Make sure you're mic'd. Is our costume correct? Voiceover is more, okay, are we in the character? Good, let's go.
Let's take a look at a clip from that.
Ooh.
First time here?
Yeah.
Oh, Dr. Francis is the best veterinarian in the business. You're gonna love him. He specializes in behavioral disorders.
Behavioral disorders?
Yeah.
But I don't have a behavioral disorder. I mean, I worry a little, sure, but it's a dangerous world. You'd be crazy not to worry.
Yeah, I'm fine, too. It's my human that's nuts. I mean, you know, I bring her a dead bird, she throws it out. I bring her a dead mouse right in the garbage. There's nothing I don't got enough for you, mother!
Okay.
It's an interesting premise.
It's especially interesting in that it's an animated movie where it's such a strong ensemble. It's not just the one character. I mean, obviously, I have a whole story where my character goes to a farm, which you would think he'd be very excited. But then Kevin Hart is amazing in it. His bunny character.
Yeah, I'm going to be the first bunny with washboard abs.
Jenny Slate.
Any plans today?
Eric Stone.
We're going on a trip.
Really?
Harrison Ford, first voiceover role.
Really?
Are you scared?
No. No, I'm not.
Now you're talking.
You're not standing in a room together. You're doing this at different times, right?
No, I'm not. I was not in a room with Harrison Ford. We were... You know, the director was in France, so I was on Skype with him, and then, you know, Harrison did his. So everyone, it's all technology. Everybody can be everywhere, and you can assemble them for an animated film easily.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Now, you are also, you just finished up a second season of AP Bio. That's a show on NBC.
Yes.
You did Word Girl on the one end. You did Archer on maybe the other end. You've got now Happy.
How do I get one of these?
What are you now? What? You're an animated horse? Or a,
I'm an animated
flying horse?
Unicorn Pegasus imaginary friend, a blue horse. You know, I mean, not that I'm going to compare Word Girl with Happy because they're not the same thing, but, you know, performance-wise, you are playing these very, no pun intended, cartoonishly big kind of no boundaries style characters. So you have to kind of bring the same thing to both of those. I don't really think of it in terms of, oh, well, this is a kiddie show and this is an adult show. Yeah. I want to serve whatever the material is, you know, do the best thing I can with it. And there were really, really funny, cool, hidden things on Word Girl. And there's very, very heartfelt, sweet stuff on Happy.
You're also a comic book and sci-fi fiend on a significant level.
Yes.
When did that start?
When I was a little kid, I liked superheroes and science fiction, but it wasn't until high school when it was like the 1-2 punch of discovering Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns and Harvey Pekar's American Splendor that I really felt like, oh, there's a whole other form of literature that's being reborn or at least being reinterpreted. And that felt really, because I remember, at the time I was studying poets, like you would read T.S. Eliot and James Joyce, and you were taught that at the time this was a revolutionary thing, that when it dropped, when The Wasteland appeared, it, you know, literature was not the same afterward, when you know, Howl appeared in the 60s. So I had never been able to be alive and experience a thing that appears and then changes the form of something. So seeing that in what people assume was a very disposable art form, comic books, was very exciting to me, that suddenly these multi-level, darker interpretations were being put on a cartoon character like Batman was really exciting to see. And then also to see the form of comic books being used to tell these very everyday, non-heroic stories the way that Harvey Pekar was doing it was also incredible for me.
Yeah. There is a... I remember there's an outtake that you had at Parks and Rec where you did this improv, and it's like 4 million views on YouTube already, but you just go... I'm assuming it was improv, because nobody else could have written what came out of your mouth.
Yeah.
Please allow me to finish this, because it's going to seem like a bit of a jump. We see Thanos, who was the villain teased at the end of the first Avengers movie. Now, Thanos, as you know, owns the Infinity Gauntlet, which has the time gem, the mind gem, the power gem, the space gem, and the reality gem.
That's just the stuff that's going around in your head, floating around. Like, you actually just enough about Marvel and DC and the Avengers and everything else where...
Yeah, but I think that that's floating around everyone's head on some level or another. We use stories, whether they're false, you know, and when I mean false, I mean fictional, like a myth or a heroic story, an epic, a comic book, or even the stories that I think like a sports fan will put on their team or a certain player's journey that they love, that, you know, that kind of heroic, you know, fall and rise over and over again. I think we use those to make sense of everyday life and everyday pressures where you feel so unheroic a lot of days going, I'm being ground down by the pressure of having to get my car fixed.
Yeah.
And you want to feel like, well, I could face the pressure of having to save the universe, but it's the day-to-day stuff that actually... that we overcome that makes us heroic.
Why do stand-up? I mean, you've got enough work to keep you busy. What makes you go back to...
stand-up? Because stand-up is so much fun. It's so much fun. I love the form. I love the hang. I love working with other comedians. I love the fact that it is the, I think, one of the last no-committee creative posts left where it's what I think, and I go up there and I talk. And I'm not running it by other people. I mean, if I do run it by other people, it's by other comedians, and we're doing it for fun and riffing off of each other.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is just constant fun.
I can't imagine anything that would be more vulnerable than doing stand-up. Because when you're not funny, it's just you. As you said, there's no committee. You screwed up. You didn't make
people
laugh.
It's on you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there is a... But there's two sides to that, because there is a vulnerability to stand up in that you are up there and it is on you whether it succeeds or fails.
Yeah.
But you do have a lot of advantages in that you are on stage, You're above the audience. There's a light on you. Your voice is amplified. So you are coming at it from your bets have been hedged a little bit, you know. And you would think that if people have shown up for the show, they want to laugh. They want you to do well. They're not showing up to go, oh, I hope this guy turfs out. I get to watch, you know. So you have a lot going for you. And then I think that comfort zone is what helps you become more vulnerable and honest and open on stage.
Your last stand-up dealt with some of the current day events and then also some other stuff. Let's just take a look at a clip from that. Annihilation is what it was called on Netflix.
I'm genuinely surprised that you're in such a good mood, especially with what I'm sure you guys saw what just went down on Twitter like 5 minutes ago. Did you? You didn't see? No? I'm kidding. Nothing happened, but that's that's the world we're living in right now, basically, is every... Oh, what did he do? What? Wait, what do you mean? I almost feel like I could get out of a mugging using that for the next couple of years. Like if someone put a gun in my face, give me your wallet. You know what? Just take my keys, man. It's over. Go check Twitter. What? And I just bolt like I could make it just survive.
It's true. And that couple of years is still going.
Yeah, it's really weird how this thing, Twitter, which was a very fun distraction. Now it's like, it feels like the fate of civilization hangs on Twitter now, which is not what I think it was meant to be.
Yeah.
You know, Facebook, Twitter, a way to connect us has also refocused us in some really, really bad ways. And I think it's almost affected the rhythms of conversation, and I fear that it's affected the rhythms of thought and how we approach problems. And you know, it's why someone like someone who's older, like an Elizabeth Warren, or you know, sounds so refreshing because they don't necessarily have the Twitter syntax in their voice. You're like, oh, this person sounds like they know what they're talking about. Well, because they're not talking in these weird, you know, limited character blips.
There's a kind of now famous episode where somebody who wrote back to you in a harsh way, Michael Beatty, you ended up taking a very different tone and response to this. Tell us a little bit about what happened.
Well, this guy, Michael Beatty, was, you know, this writing, I even forgot what he wrote to me. It was something vicious about, you know, because I'd said either something about Trump. My first thing was I wrote something back very snarky. And then I don't know why, but I looked through his timeline and it was like, oh my God, this guy's actually like he had facing all these health problems. He's a veteran. So I said, okay, let's maybe if we try to help him out. And what I was saying was like people like Bernie Sanders and all these people that you hate are actually, they want to make the world better for you so that you can, you know, if you are sick or you are wounded, you can deal with it with some dignity without having to beg. Like it's embarrassing that America has GoFundMes and Indiegogos. America should be run the way like small gangsters run their neighborhoods, where they brag about someone's heat gets cut off in my neighborhood, some little old lady, I take care of that. But like, that's what we should be. We shouldn't be bragging about the amount of weapons we have or the amount of strength. We should brag about, in our country, GoFundMe had to close its doors because no one needs it anymore, because when someone gets sick, we take care. Like, we have things in place where no one has to go begging.
What were the details of his life that caught your attention?
He was a veteran who was, he had suffered some kind of like
health problems
with septic shock, or it was just really bad, and he was in a bad way, and I was like, let's meet his GoFundMe goals so he can live with some dignity. And you know, unfortunately, I've seen him since on Twitter, the way he responds to people, he's kind of gone back to his kind of MAGA, which is like but you know, but it was like I wasn't so much trying to, yes, I was trying to help him, but I was also like, maybe the act itself will get signal boosted and other people. And by the way, I was inspired by Sarah Silverman basically did the same thing a year before, where a guy came after her and then she went through his timeline and said, oh my God, this guy's back is all messed up and there's no one there to help him. Can anyone like, you know, she just, so I was like, oh, maybe I'm going to try that. So that, you know, so, and again, I don't know if she changed this person's mind, but it was like, her act made me do that, and maybe more people will do that.
Yeah. One of the things that came out of your Annihilation stand-up in Netflix, the last one, was you figured out a very strange way to help the audience laugh about a personal tragedy of yours, the passing of your wife.
Mother's Day, we'll be at the airport and we'll travel, and I'll make that day really fun, and I'll fill that with adventure, and I'll keep her mind off it all day, and we'll be home, and we'll deal with this all again next year, step by step. So now we're at the airport, we're walking up to the security gate. I'm like, I think I pulled this off. Here, sweetie, here's your ticket. Give her your ticket. She loves to hand up her ticket. Here it is. So I go, here's your ticket. She gives the gate lady her ticket. I give the gate lady my ticket. She's a very old, sweet Polish woman. And we're walking onto the plane. Just as we're about to go down the tunnel, her hand falls on my shoulder. And she says, I hear what happened to your wife. She looks at Alice, to your mother, to be without your mother on Mother's Day. My mother died when I was your age. I never get over it. I never, I'm still so sad. My father never get over it. It broke him. He died alone. But when you are sad, what I tell myself is that also there are so many other sad people.
There's a section of that, maybe the last 15, 20 minutes, where you could hear a pin drop. It was almost like a bizarre, cathartic moment where people are just wondering, what's happening here? And the rousing applause you get at the end, right? It's, they witnessed something happening.
It was really, well, I mean, because I think they witnessed me being really, really frightened on stage. And being in silence that long for a comedian is really terrifying, and not knowing if you're going to pull out of it. And even though at that point, I had been doing the show long enough, that set and that material, that I felt like I knew where the laughs were, even though there was long silences. I'm like, well, but there was still a fear in me that when I would get there doing the show and when everyone's seeing the cameras and everything, and they were, I had a fear the audience would go, nah, this isn't cool, I don't want to watch this, and we shouldn't be laughing at this. Like, I still, so I didn't know that it would work until after it worked. And it was really, really nerve-wracking for me.
Yeah, and you were very public about your grieving process, or at least there was lots of information that was out there about it. I know that you didn't obviously grieve completely in public, but why did you do that?
Because a lot of the stuff that got me through it were from people that had grieved in public beforehand, and they either wrote it down or, you know, I read C.S. Lewis's A Grief Observed. I was reading a lot of Annie Lamott. And those people were brave enough to very much put their grieving out there. Cheryl Strayed was another one of just whatever shipwreck they found themselves in. They went, well, I'm going to do this publicly, so maybe someone else can have something. So I kind of did that, like thinking maybe this will help someone else, and then did the special the way that I did it, thinking, well, down the road, maybe someone else will go through this and they can look at this.
It doesn't need to be hidden.
No, I think we hide too much disease and grief so that then when it hits other people, they feel like, well, I've never seen this happen, so I must be the only person going through this, and it feels way more dire than it needs to be. You know, and I was very lucky that, you know, I and Alice had a grief group to go to so we could, you know, work through this stuff. It was not easy.
You talk about your daughter, Alice, in the stand-up quite a bit and then other things. What have you learned about dealing with grief, watching her go through it?
Thing that I learned was that children are way more resilient than adults, that children bounce back from stuff and turn damage and trauma into positive things way quicker than we do. And I think mainly because they still see the world is new and newer stuff coming on. And I think as you get older, you're like, well, I've seen a lot of this before. And this grief is going to, I don't know what new is coming down the pike for me. So
it sounds like she was helping you more than you being.
Oh, she helped me. I remember 3 days into it or 4 days into it. We were up all night. We couldn't sleep, but neither of us. And then my daughter, who was, you know, she was 7 at the time, said, when your mom dies, you're the best memory of her. Everything you do is a memory of her. She said that.
Wow.
And I wrote it. I ran and I got a piece of paper and I wrote that down. But that was this. And it wasn't her like coming up with something profound out of nowhere. That was clearly something that she had been thinking of for days. And how do I say this and how do I articulate this?
Hmm.
It was amazing. It was amazing to hear that. Like, that was a huge help for me. Because it made me look at her in a different way of like, no, this is not this fragile kid that has to. She wants to go and be in the sunlight and experience life in order to assuage the grief of losing her mom.
Yeah.
Like, the better the life she lives, the better it is for the memory of her mom.
Pat Oswalt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yep.
And what a powerful way to deal with grief. But that's it for now. Tomorrow, we'll be in Normandy to commemorate the 75th anniversary of D-Day, so we'll see you from there. Meantime, remember you can always listen to our podcast and see us online at amanpour.com, and you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks for watching. And earlier, we brought you the amazing story of Rudolf Nureyev, so as we say goodbye, we want to leave you with another great moment from his brilliant ballet career.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.